Good morning. You're listening to WMFO 91.5 FM, Tufts Free Form, commercial free, community based radio. And for the next 2 hours, you'll be listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we're on every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And today is March 27th, perhaps. Let me look at my phone, get that right. And your host today is myself, Jeff, and sometimes we have co-hosts, sometimes we don't. We were expecting Diego today, some semi-regular guest and co-host. I guess he couldn't make it in. Maybe we'll hear from him. And welcome to the show. Today we're going to be talking about, what else? The corporate elections, yes. And remember, you are listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, so you're going to get not the usual corporate media take on things. But we're going to put the corporate elections, the bourgeois elections, into some context for you. And we're going to talk about Bernie Sanders, of course. The question of Bernie Sanders, if you want to put it that way, the phenomena of Bernie Sanders, is a interesting one for someone that's been a socialist for a long time, like myself, that's been in a socialist organization. When you have someone that is labeled a socialist by some, running in a Democratic Party primary as a Democrat for President of the United States, that's a bit of a game changer in some ways, obviously. So I have people, for example, where I work, ask me what I think of Bernie Sanders, and they're expecting me to jump up and down in glee. And, you know, after 20 years of talking or more of talking about socialism and talking about real socialists like Shama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A, space S-A-W-A-N-T, Shama Sawant, getting elected in Seattle City Council 2 times now as a socialist, as an independent socialist, member of Socialist Alternative, open socialist, and talking about international issues like I often do, and socialists in other countries, and then to be here where someone like Sanders, who is not a socialist, I'll cut to the chase, but I'll get back into that later as to why that is, be described as one, and people sort of redefining socialism as anything acceptable to capitalism, and real socialism is not, and not because it's so crazily radical, but just because it doesn't go along with the machinery of capitalism, basically. If you're living in an economic system that depends on its existence for the exploitation of cheap labor and natural resources for short-term maximization of profit, which is basically the equation of capitalism if it's going to continue, all backed up by a strong, coercive nation state, and in fact a network of nations, of powerful, rich nation states at the top, right now the U.S., of course, another name for the combination of economic and military power exerting itself internationally is called imperialism. That's a big word socialists throw around. It's kind of shorthand. It's pretty good shorthand, I think, because it brings to mind coercion, force, imperial power, and abuse. And so we're in a world where the reality, including the relentless reality that working people face, that we face in our workplaces, in our communities, of neoliberal, another big word, basically just capitalist, austerity programs, and austerity, another big word, meaning cuts in social services, cuts in jobs, job security, that sort of thing, cuts in benefits. You know, the corporate executives haven't got the memo from Bernie, you know, from Sanders about that stuff. And so the reality, even during an election period, is much different than the reality that many people are constructing for themselves to make sense of the world or words, and the reality that's the mythology being constructed around elections, which happens regularly. So anyway, that's what we're going to talk about today, the elections and the context for the elections. And some of it will seem a little beyond that rubric, but that's basically beyond those parameters, but that's basically where we're coming from today. on Socialist Alternative Radio. Again, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. We're here every other Sunday at WMFO 91.5 FM, also known as WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford, as I said earlier. And we're known by many names here at WMFO. We are Tufts Educational Radio. We are Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. And as you can probably guess, Socialist Alternative Radio is a little piece of that community base. We've been on the air here many years, and we've gotten great feedback. We have a Facebook page, Socialist Alternative Radio. Please check it out. But we're also here, not just as you may guess, this is part of our what we try to do. We're not just here to give alternative views and information like some other shows do that are on the left, and we salute them. We're not just critical of them. We salute them. We wish they were more open about their politics. There's sort of a carryover from, let's say, the 90s, to pick a time, or early 2000s or whatever, of people hiding their radical affiliations, whether they're socialist or whatever. And one thing that predates, to go back to the elections for a moment, one thing that predates the Sanders campaign, but also I think is influenced by the Sanders campaign, is the attitudes towards socialism, however ill-defined that might be, however wrong the label might be in certain cases, like with Sanders. There's still a loosening up, and I've got some articles about that from the Washington Post, of all places. They're op-ed pieces, but still, of attitudes towards socialism changing. And we've talked about this on the show before with polling data from, I forget the source, it was maybe Pew or some other well-known polling data we've talked about over the years, including recently, every year for the last couple, 2 or 3 years, we've featured that polling data on the show that keeps attitudes towards the word socialism, not defined, but socialism, keep improving, especially among people of color, especially among youth, and even among the, you know, more conservative elements. There was even a poll that had a certain percentage of Republicans having a favorable view towards the word socialism, which is very interesting, you know, like worth thinking about in a way. When political labels in the United States, I would argue, with exceptions, I can think of anecdotal exceptions to this, but political labels in the United States are pretty fluid, because the political parties that dominate, the Republican and Democratic Party, they're not really political parties in the sense of having a membership and having democratic structures that millions of people are involved in. They are more electoral machines, and they'll create structures around elections that people can get involved in through voting, so you can register as a voter under a label. You don't have to stick to it as a Democrat or Republican. And if you are an elected official as a Democrat or Republican, or if you have ties to those elected officials, you may get invited to the temporary structures that are built around certain campaigns, like we're seeing happening now with the primaries. So temporarily you'll be asked to do something, be in a caucus for this election or something like that, or what, you know, the different names they call the primary structures. And then you may be asked to become a professional, you know, if you're of a small number of people that actually make some money off of elections through campaigning, or maybe you're part of the big money movers and shakers, backroom deal makers in the Democratic or Republican Party that actually make a living off of the politics of serving capitalism by making sure this electoral machine gets geared up when necessary. Much different, all that, from a political party with traditions of voting on party policy in meetings, large and small, having a constitution and program that are well known, that are transparent, having structures that transcend electoral work and electoral times, elections, into other types of activities and political activities, other types of political activities that the party would be known for. So comparing corporate, or as socialists sometimes say, bourgeois, meaning ruling class, upper capitalist class people, and their institutions, comparing those kind of political parties, Democrats, Republicans, to left-wing political parties or even other types of political formations, doesn't have to necessarily be left-wing, where the party has actually a membership base, has permanent democratic structures, or permanent as long as the party lasts, and as I said, transparent functioning, you know, conventions where there's voting and stuff like that. Now you'll hear the word Democratic Party or Republican Party convention used for what they do. That's very carefully orchestrated and really done in a more or less ad hoc basis. I mean, it's planned, but it's planned for certain times and then it disappears. Doesn't happen at all levels of the party, etc. Anyway, I don't want to get into like more about these definitions, but they are important when thinking about the elections. And if you write off, if you're a socialist, if you're an activist and you want to organize people in the future, and something happens in the elections, as is inevitable in the way that the elections are run in this country, something happens in the elections or in the aftermath that is really quite a betrayal or quite horrible. Everything from someone getting elected that you can't imagine how they got in the primaries, much less being elected, or once elected, someone that you think is good, betraying every last thing that they stood for in the election. This is typical in U.S. politics. And I mention U.S. here because we do have international listeners. Thank you, international listeners. Please write to us more on Facebook, Socialist Alternative, on radio, on Facebook, Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. And the fact that, you know, so much is just not in the realm of these elections, and they're just a snapshot, really, of a mood of a certain section of the population at a given time. But they're not treated that way. They're not treated like, well, the day after the election, really, other things can happen. And they are significant. They are worth paying attention to. I'm not making an argument that they're insignificant. I'm just making an argument that things can change very rapidly after an election, based on changes in the economy, for example, in the political situation itself. But people get very demoralized. Of course, I've seen this many, many times. At elections as they shape up or as they are followed through on as they happen, and especially in the aftermath. You know, a good example is a certain number of youth that I talk to, that I, you know, students and so on, that I talk to about politics and try to get involved in socialist politics and socialist alternative. One of the last big political things they may have done is vote for Obama, or at least be interested, if they're not, weren't old enough to vote, to be interested in the Obama campaign, and especially in 2008, especially around slogans like hope and change and si se puede and all that stuff. Now, sounds kind of silly. We've talked about on the show before that to have any illusions in Obama, on the one hand, was you know, foolish, because he also did mention from time to time that when pressed what he believed in, and he believed firmly in capitalism. He extolled Ronald Reagan in his book, in the book Obama wrote, Reagan being the epitome, sort of the Donald Trump of the late 70s, early 80s, if you will. And so it's really amazing that more people didn't see that. But then again, you step back and you say, well, what is the corporate media for? It's not there for nothing. I mean, you don't pour billions of dollars into propaganda as a ruling class, and the way the airwaves are structured and so on. I mean, I'm broadcasting now from a small signal college station, the far left of the dial, which I find adequate. I mean, I find, you know, that's apropos, that's good. But anyway, small signal. And all the left so-called shows, that there's probably about three or four of them in the area that broadcast over the airwaves and not just over the internet, that are more than podcasts, are relegated to the same sort of format. And meanwhile, you know, daily on radio, and of course more, you know, every other media outlet platform you can think of, there's the bombardment of the corporate media. And I really, and, you know, of course, there's this counter narrative now that the social media and so on is usurping corporate media. And I think that's overblown. I think there's a grain of truth in it that you can generate some information outside the normal channels through corporate media, through social media, to use the broad term for like Facebook and all that. And that's good, you know, that's great. It's a tool for socialist activists to spread their word and so on. But there's still, if you're on Facebook, you notice there's a lot of content circulated from the corporate media still on Facebook, directly or forwarded by people on Facebook. So it's not like you escape the influence of the corporate media in social media. And there's a material reason for that. Who has the money to collect data and analyze it? Who has the money to so-called investigate things when they bother to do that? Who has the money to assimilate a certain perspective, assimilate a certain amount of data, put into a perspective, and then broadcast it over different platforms that cost a lot of money, and you have capitalists buying up, as they have been ever since it was organized this way, buying up multiple television, radio outlets and so on to make sure that basically a certain worldview gets out there. Nothing new. Everyone, you know, this basic corporate media critique is one of the first things a lot of people come to when they start criticizing society, when they start to sort of wake up from accepting the status quo. The first thing you notice is how skewed the media is. And even people that buy into the system, like, for example, when right-wingers say the media is liberal left bias and all that, you know, on the one hand, that's kind of crazy, obviously, the media. Liberal, yes, but liberal and conservative are two sides of the same coin, the two sides of the same pro-capitalist coin, and there's not much difference. There is differences, obviously, but not much difference between them in terms of worldview and what their goals are and so on. So you can talk about liberal bias all you want. And you're going to talk, if you're a Republican or conservative, you're going to find out liberal bias is not that different from what really you believe in or what you're talking about, unless you're far right or something. And the same is true for liberals that notice here and there conservative radio stations or, for example, notice NPR is getting more conservative with the influence of the Koch brothers and the widow, Ray Kroc's widow there from McDonald's and so on. NPR. Yeah, NPR's on a very small scale, very small line of bias, which everyone is, and every institution is biased, it's getting more conservative, but it was never radical. It was never left, like some people would ascribe to it. And so the same thing in the corporate media as a whole. People can sort of spend a lot of time spinning their wheels in trying to dissect the corporate media in general, when it's pretty clear what it's there for and what the parameters are. Now, some of that is worth it. I mean, I read that Fair and Actually in reporting. I get their emails, and I have one I might get to today, and that's worth it, you know, because to see how the information is spun and all that. But it's not the be-all and end-all, and it's to be expected, unfortunately, while capitalism rules, that it also rules the corporate media. It also rules the educational institutions. It also rules religious institutions. It also rules, it gets its claws into NGOs, of course, and rules and creates non-governmental organizations. There's no escape from corporate rule under capitalism. It affects everyone, and capitalism affects everyone and everything. Even people that are fighting to change the system from capitalism to democratic socialism. And by the way, that's not the democratic socialism of Bernie Sanders. And by the way, if you are a first-time listener, I meant to get into this earlier. Again, this is Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working-class democratic socialist perspective. And what that is all about is not just, as I started getting into earlier, not just information dissemination from a sort of left viewpoint, or not sort of, from a left viewpoint. It's also about getting involved in what we perceive as a socialist movement. And that's, again, not Bernie Sanders. It predates Bernie Sanders, and Sanders really isn't a part of a socialist movement. He's running as a Democrat. But Socialist Alternative is a real, breathing socialist organization in political solidarity with the Committee for Workers International. If you want more information, go to info@socialistalternative.org. Go to socialistalternative.org's website. Go to socialistworld.net for the website of the Committee for Workers International. And in the New England area, because we're broadcasting here from Greater Boston, more specifically Medford and Somerville, Massachusetts, which borders Boston, we are reachable many different ways. In Boston, call 910-639-3948. In Worcester, 617-285-9346. And, you know, various other places around New England. Nationally, you can call 206-526-7185. Or again, just Facebook.com, Socialist Alternative USA, etc. All those neat ways. Twitter, at Socialist Alt, all that cool stuff. And, you know, we have a monthly paper. We have a good website, all sorts of ways to reach out, but also ways to get you involved. You know, like I mentioned earlier, we did get a candidate, an open socialist, open member Socialist Alternative elected to Seattle City Council, a major city in the United States, obviously, not just once, but two times. Shama Sawant recently reelected for another term, and that was a big deal, reelected with a wide margin. So if you're wondering what a socialist looks like in practice, again, I would not point you to Bernie Sanders. I would point you to Shama Sawant on a local, more localized level, definitely, but still a big, you know, area, city. There are there's a rich history of socialism in the United States. Check out Eugene Debs, for example, and in the latest issue of Socialist Alternative, there was an article about Eugene Debs, a book review of The Bending Cross. And, for example, from labor leader to five-time Socialist Party candidate for president, Eugene Debs was the voice of American workers in revolt. And there's several biographies of Debs out there. One is The Bending Cross by Ray Ginger, G-I-N-G-E-R. And there's a short article by Ginger Jensen on page 11 of the newest issue of Socialist Alternative newspaper. I think you can find most of it online, if not all of it. And there's a whole thing, I won't go into the whole history of Debs, but he was a labor leader, became a socialist. Once he became a socialist, he never looked back. He recognized, quote, quoting from the article, recognizing clearly that the Democratic Party was controlled by the capitalist class, and that the key challenge was to build a working class party independent of big business and the Democratic Party. I add that, the last part, in the Democratic Party. Debs ran for president, by the way, won millions of votes, but never the presidency. He never expected to, but he was doing it to help build the Socialist Party. And by the way, his showing in those elections, getting over a million votes from prison, or I'm sorry, near a million votes from prison at the time when he ran around World War One, because he was thrown in prison for opposing World War One, for speaking against it. They talk about free speech, and that, of course, is thrown overboard a lot in this country. The whole that doesn't protect you. And Debs was not protected by the free speech of the so-called of the Constitution. And he ended up in prison, but he ran for president of prison and got the enormous, for the time, enormous number of votes. So, anyway, so this show, by the way, about not just information from a left-wing perspective, from a socialist perspective, from a democratic socialist perspective, but also about getting involved. And we hope that things you hear on the show will get you interested in becoming a part of the socialist movement that's out there, that can get you interested in joining Socialist Alternative as one organization out there fighting for socialism. The left in the U.S. is pretty small. That's definitely true, mainly because we don't have the big left-wing political parties in our more recent history. The Socialist Party in the U.S., well, it did get pretty big at the time in the early 20th century, but that's been a long time ago. And one thing that suffers in a country without a Socialist Party or a Communist Party, Labor Party, some sort of big left-wing party in recent memory, is that historical memory itself is affected. That's a little hard to explain, but I'll try in a quick soundbite. Basically, say you're in Britain and you go to school and you get the perfunctory history lesson from the British school, which is still dominated by the institution of schooling, still dominated by the capitalists in Britain. But there's a indisputable historical fact, or pretty much indisputable, one that will be probably glossed over, but still there, that at some point in fairly recent British history, there was a creation of a Labour Party created solely by workers and the labour movement in order to be totally independent of the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party, the Tories and the Liberals, in terms of where money came from the party, in terms of program, in terms of interest. This party, the Labour Party, when it started, was for the working class. And if you and I'm not saying the teachers will do this, but if you dig a little deeper into it, because now that you have that one, that knowledge, oh, there was a party for working people, you know, something we don't have some reference to in the United States on a superficial basis. I mean, you can dig for it, find out about the Socialist Party, find out about other socialist movements, but in the United States, but basically you have the situation where it's like, for example, with Bernie Sanders, people calling Sanders a socialist, or the even the media calling him a socialist, because there's so little knowledge of what real a real socialist movement was or is at this point in time in U.S. history. Whereas in other countries, the memory of real socialist movements, even if they've degenerated terribly, the memory, the historical memory, is there, partially kept alive by the parties still existing or in formation. There are, in Europe, for example, there are a lot of left parties that have degenerated to pro-capitalist parties, but in their wake are many new formations that are anti-capitalist, that are trying to become new socialist, communist, labor parties, whatever you want to call it, workers' parties of different sorts. And they're doing so in a way that it happens much more, evolves and happens much more rapidly than in the United States, because people in Europe are already used to multiple party, multi-party elections and multi-party electoral processes in general, whereas here it's still the duopoly, as they say, the two parties, two sides of the same corporate coin ruling over us. Well, that's a segue into Sanders, which I was going to save for later, but I'll jump into it a little bit right now. So Sanders deciding to run as a Democrat in the Democratic Party has really set back that whole drive, I would call it, towards independent politics in this country. And what do I mean by drive towards that? Well, more and more people becoming dissatisfied with the two-party system. More and more favorable attitudes, again, this predates Sanders running, towards socialism, coming out of the Occupy movement, coming out of the globalization movement, et cetera. Not mass movements, but still had an effect. Occupy, for example, was a real mess, but it at least brought out, forced the corporate media to pay attention to inequality a little bit. And of course, the objective conditions of a recession that has never really lifted for millions and millions of working people, or has resulted in a in precarious or substandard, substandard is a weird word, but I'll say precarious, meaning not very secure, and also a step back from before or from what people thought is the reality in a time when we're being told things are getting better economically. Now, in the United States, here, for example, and around where I live and observe, you can see actually more help wanted signs out there. I think the idea is that I think the general idea right now among a lot of people is if I lost my job, I could probably get another job. Of course, there's a lot of qualifiers to that. It's not definite. I personally wouldn't feel that confident just because I've been unemployed before, and I know the different elements that go into being able to secure a job, especially one that would be more than temporary, literally. That's now a legal definition, temp worker, in the United States here. But say I feel like a little more comfortable, there's more jobs out there. The unemployment statistics, as you've probably read or heard about, are pretty skewed, and there's actually more unemployed more people that have given up looking for work and they're not counted, people that are not counted for various reasons in general with the unemployment figures. But even taking that into account, a little more leeway in terms of losing a job and possibly finding another one. But the big problem is, once you find that other job, is it going to match the pay of the job you left? There's been many studies done over the course of the Great Recession, quote unquote, starting in 2007, 2008, and up till to now, where, of course, you know the answer already, many of you know you're going to get another job, but the pay and benefits are going to be weaker. They're going to be less because the labor movement is weaker, much weaker than it was. Even in the last 30 years, there's been a swift decline in a weakened, already weakened labor movement down to an even weaker labor movement. And by the way, one of the most conservative strata of the country seems to be labor leaders hanging on to policies and strategies that obviously didn't work, but oftentimes acting like towards socialists and towards members of social alternatives sometimes, not always, sometimes there's very friendly relations, but sometimes it's like, who are you crazy socialists coming in and wanting to do this or that, you know, urging us to do this or that. Well, Mr. or Mrs. Labor Leader or Ms. Labor Leader, look around. Your policies obviously aren't working. You're down to 6%. And I say this as a union member, as a completely loyal 110% pro-union union member, but I keep you know, rhetorically waiting. I don't really believe this, but I keep rhetorically waiting for the labor leaders to wake up and say, yeah, we've sucked. We really, really don't understand capitalism. Some of us are pro-capitalist. We have no business being labor leaders. We all resign. Right now, the best thing that could happen to the United States working class is if the labor leadership, if 99% of it just resigned, you know, out of shame, and went and asked, begged forgiveness of the working class. But of course, that's just a fantasy. The reality is they'll hang on tooth and nail for their perks, for their pensions that the members are losing, but the labor leaders will hang on to. And they want to just retire, a lot of them. They don't care if their union gets swallowed up in a merger or disappears, really, as long as they escape personally. And that's a sad fact. It took me a while to get used to that. I used to believe, like a lot of people in the socialist movement, people even in Social Alternative, when we got going in this country in the 80s, we believed that, well, you know, the labor leaders are going to wake up a little bit, at least, some of them at least, because their own futures are at stake. You know, they get their money from union dues and things are getting worse. This was obvious even back in the late 70s with Carter and all the deregulation led by the liberals. It was decimating the trucking unions, decimating the airline unions, and et cetera, and into the 80s with Reagan and all that. It was just obvious where the labor movement was going. In the 90s, the attempt to get a labor party going, and the stupid labor leaders still hanging on to the Democrats' coattails like they're still doing. By the way, supporting Sanders is still hanging on to the Democratic Party's coattails, in my opinion. By the way, I should qualify a lot of the stuff I say about Sanders. Is some of it is definitely, you know, part of the analysis of Socialist Alternative, but some of it is my own opinion, because there is actually discussion and debate within Socialist Alternative about what is the nature of Sanders's campaign and how to orientate towards it, and you know, there are a lot of Socialist Alternative members doing this movement for hashtag movement for Bernie. Campaigning for Sanders, supporting Sanders, and everybody in Social Alternative, I hope, and I've done this, is interested in orientating towards Sanders when there's a rally or something, going to the rally and trying to engage people, sell our newspaper, that kind of thing, get people interested in real socialism through a friendly approach, because Sanders is raising issues that are you know, rooted somewhat in socialism, or at least you could say in social democracy. By European standards, Sanders would be a right-wing social democrat, but here in the U.S., talking about free education for public schools, talking about single-payer health care, despite taxes he wants to put on working people, talking about to achieve that, talking about $50 minimum wage, which he came too late, but still he's raising it now from time to time. And his general, political revolution rhetoric, problematic because he refuses to criticize capitalism as a whole. If you dig into his campaign and his ideas more, he refuses to as a socialist would do, to talk about taking corporations that are failing or threatening layoffs or doing all sorts of nasty things, taking them under public ownership or nationalizing them in a democratic way. As we would advocate as socialists, he doesn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. He says he's against that. So Sanders is really not a socialist, but he's raising ideas that are progressive in some cases and would help working people. And then that label of socialist that he had way back in the 80s and, you know, has stuck to a certain extent. I heard even Obama referring to him as a democratic socialist. Of course, he's also referred to often as Democrat Bernie Sanders or Democratic Party candidate Bernie Sanders and all that, which is much more accurate. Sanders spent, you know, the 90s basically working with the Democratic Party, nominally as an independent, but basically working with the Democratic Party and being rewarded for supporting their candidates on a national and somewhat local level in Vermont, being rewarded with committee assignments and seniority on committees and all that. And Sanders has pledged many times that he will obey the results of the primary and what that has meant with people like Sanders in the past, like Jesse Jackson and Dennis Kucinich and others that chose to bury their political work in their electoral work in the Democratic Party. Even though calling themselves progressive, they have given over their delegates and their resources and support and everything to the, the candidate that wins the primary, which looks like it's going to be Hillary Clinton. Sanders has pledged that he would give Clinton his support if she wins. Now you may notice in the primaries that are happening lately, Sanders is ascendant. He's winning a lot. And on the one hand, you know, that's interesting because more people are going to hear about some of those issues, I hope. I mean, I don't listen to all his speeches, but I hope he's still talking about $15 minimum wage and free education and so on, and getting a little more specific than he often does in the speeches I do hear, where he leaves it kind of a general tapping into class anger type of speech, which I understand, but we really need more than that. And we'll never get it through the Democratic Party, unfortunately. Well, not unfortunately, that's just a fact of life. I mean, anyone should know that. But that follows left politics in the U.S. But anyway, so Sanders is putting forward these demands, many of which are supportable by socialists, by real socialists. So going to a Sanders rally, talking to people, engaging them, you know, having an information table, whatever, that's great stuff. But also at the same time, once, you know, gaining a rapport with someone or just in the material that's handed out and so on, it should say somewhere, but as real socialists or whatever, however you phrase that nicely, we're not supporting a Democratic Party candidate. We're not supporting someone running through the Democratic Party. You can't win these demands through the Democratic Party. Sanders, with all his electoral support, this is still not a movement. It's just a campaign. And if elected, he would be completely isolated. That's part of the problem of running as a Democrat. Ironically, if you're a real socialist, which he's not, running in the Democratic Party actually isolates you. It doesn't give you the troops you need, the members you need, the party structure you need that would have to be an independent party, a socialist party of some sort, that could actually build movements to actually achieve $15 minimum wage at a national level, or to achieve, single-payer health care, or to achieve free education. Sanders himself, it's interesting, says, I used to say at least earlier in his campaign, it would take a movement to achieve a lot of these things. He has no record as a movement builder, which is the dilemma there. But if he ran as an independent and was helping, if he had run as independent, if he in the future, near future, decided to run as independent, then he would be able to build more effectively actual movements to, not more effectively, but effectively, build national movements that could then help all these issues. But and that's one thing that Social Alternative did with the campaign for Shama Sawant to win. Initially, the campaign for city council included demands, and very quickly, one demand seemed to catch the ear of the population more than any, which was the $50 minimum wage, which we ended up initiating a campaign through the electoral campaign and after the electoral campaign to win to win a $50 minimum wage in Seattle, the first win in a city in the whole country in 2014 or 2015, perhaps. I might have the chronology off a little bit, early 2015. And quickly followed by other cities. And that was a great victory, despite, you know, there's some problems with how it's being implemented over time, but it still, you know, has already gotten tens of thousands of workers substantial raises throughout Seattle. And to win that kind of, that did take a movement. And the electoral work was done in part, in great part to get that movement going and to keep that movement going. And to win, right? Sanders is running to get elected himself. And then he says that will then translate into gains through the Democratic, as by being a Democratic Party president or whatever, or shifting the party to the left in the primaries, quote unquote, and then handing it over to Clinton. Now, both of those things are completely flawed. The Democratic Party is shifted, quote unquote, to the left many times historically, and it's not a real left it's shifting to. It's just tapping into a mood that exists. Like, you know, take for example the Democratic Party in the late 60s, early 70s, the McGovern becoming the Democratic Party candidate at one point for president is no accident. It reflected the mood to a certain extent in the country. And by the way, he was betrayed with a lot of Democrats, including Democrats kind of ran the show and didn't really want McGovern, but he managed to get in anyway, voting against McGovern, working against McGovern. And there's other examples, of course, FDR in the 30s, four terms of adroit, if that's the right word, four terms of skillful left populism, devoid of any sort of real anti-capitalism, devoid of any lasting gains in many ways, except through a mass movement that almost turned into a revolutionary movement in this country. But then historically, that is all turned into, oh, that was Roosevelt that did that. You know, instead of seeing the meteoric rise of the Communist Party in the 30s, the rise of the CIO unions, rise of other radical groups, putting enough pressure through mass movements, including the big general strike wave in 1934, Minneapolis Teamster strike, San Francisco dock workers strike, Toledo Auto Light workers strike, and then the sit-down strikes in 36 and 37, in other words, plant occupations or factory occupations, and also retail workplace occupations and other types of workplaces occupied by the thousands in the United States. There was a huge mass movement, often these movements led by radicals, by communists, socialists, etc., and and that created the conditions where Roosevelt quite readily admitted that he was there not to harm capitalism, as his more right wing critics would say, but he was there to save it, and he did. He would brag he did save it. Now that's of course too reductionist. One individual doesn't play that role fully. It's institutional and political, you know, mass movements and all sorts of mass psychology and other factors involved there. But Roosevelt decided to defend himself to his right wing critics by saying, "Hey, some of you business people getting so excited about? I saved your butts. I saved capitalism for you." So getting back to the current elections, though. The Democratic Party is certainly flexible enough to tack left at times, and Sanders is part of that. And if he wins, if you're really interested in democratic socialism and socialism, be careful what you wish for, because he'll be isolated. He won't be able to follow through on any of the things he's promised, not because Congress is deadlocked and all that kind of stuff. That's a minor thing in a way. because it's more because that Sanders chose to run in the Democratic Party, and he does not have a political party behind him, or that he's a part of that can hold him accountable, and that can actually build a movement or movements to get these things passed that he's talking about. Would there be no reforms under a Sanders administration? Oh, there would be some, sure. But then, of course, there would be a lot of hand-wringing about the deadlocked Congress, which would include many Democrats deadlocking things, by the way. And Sanders, you know, he's given no indication he's doing this campaign to build a movement. If he did, he would be running as an independent. And there's still time. I mean, there's still one scenario that could work itself out. I mean, it's not likely at all, based on what I've already said, but I wouldn't say not likely at all, but I'm saying it's not very likely that Sanders could choose to run as an independent all of a sudden, even within the short time between now and November, and go with Jill Stein, even work with her, figure some sort of ticket out where Sanders and Jill Stein would run together. Jill Stein is the most likely nominee of the Green Party for president. Now, what is the U.S. Green Party? Let's take a second to talk about that. Again, if we're putting, the theme of today's show is putting the elections in some context, this will be good context in case you don't know about it. The Green Party is perceived by many as left, as progressive. If you read their program, there's definitely progressive elements in it. Unfortunately, it's also got pro-capitalist elements in it, so it's a mix. And there is discussion within the Green Party to the extent that it exists institutionally. The other problem with the Green Party is it tends to define itself more as an electoral formation, in some ways mimicking the Democratic and Republican parties that way, but does have more of a membership base and ways that people, the average person in the Green Party, can engage in trying to help form policies and so on, much, much more democratically, although with major flaws, but still much more democratically than anything the Democratic or Republican parties have on offer for the average person. And so the Green Party, also, the main reason we're talking about it is it got to a certain size in this country where it has ballot status in various states. And so progressives and left-wingers, including just, by the way, as a marker to show what I mean, ex-Black Panthers like Bruce Dixon and Aaron Dixon and others have run on the Green Party ballot in all sorts of places because that ballot line exists. They start to run. There's no one in the Green Party kind of trying to keep them to the straight and narrow of the Green Party program. And they're able to put out their own ideas to a certain extent and still get the party's nod. And that's a good thing. Ralph Nader ran, I think, one or two times straight-up Green Party candidate. What Socialist Alternative did and what I also think was a good idea as a member of Socialist Alternative is never to endorse the Green Party as a whole, but to endorse some of their left-wing candidates, like Nader when he ran for Green Party, like Howie Hawkins when he ran recently in New York for governor, I believe it was, maybe it was Senate, sorry if I don't remember that accurately, to endorse basically Aaron Dixon in Seattle, Bruce Dixon in Georgia and so on, to endorse Green Party left-wingers that are clearly left-wing, putting forward a program to the left of the Green Party program, and to help them in their campaigns. And since the Green Party gets no money from big business, no corporate money, not tied to the Democrats or the Republicans, this is a good thing for Sanders and anyone else interested in independent politics to get involved with, not necessarily to join the Green Party, but to just work with them in a United Front type coalition. United Front meaning, you know, people are still building their own organizations and open about who they are, but working together on issues and so on. And including, I would argue, electoral strategy is an issue, and that the Green Party, through its ballot access, through its nominally progressive program, and through its history of allowing left-wingers to run on its ballot, lines some of the time, is all very positive. You know, now there's also some negatives. Obviously, the Green Party, one I already mentioned, the huge one is a pro-capitalist program to a certain extent, a tendency for Green Party members to have very low party loyalty and affiliation. I think part of that goes to the Green Party, since it has more of a reality than the Republican or Democratic Party in terms of a membership structure and so on. It should be out running campaigns more, not be totally focused on electoral politics, truly shift to the left and becoming anti-capitalist. Jill Stein has said some things in terms of like need for nationalizing corporations in certain circumstances, the need for other positions. She's been way to the left of Sanders in a good sense, not ultra left, but to the left of Sanders, and putting up ideas that are, you know, could easily be supported by socialists. And so basically, Jill Stein and the Green Party, whether it moves left or not, is a factor, ultimately moves left or not, is a factor in this election. And if Sanders hooked up with Jill Stein and the Green Party, if the Greens run on their own after Sanders capitulates, hopefully the Green Party will have more notice, will get more support, and we'll be able to get on more ballot lines and so on. And the way that I think a mass socialist party, communist party, labor party, radical party, whatever you want to call it, workers' party of some sort, the way it will be formed in this country, and we talk about this a lot in Socialist Alternative, is through a lot of different streams, most likely. It's not going to be this neat, march to, like, from the labor movement, just the labor movement or just the Green Party, to just growing exponentially, either one of them, and taking on independent politics and forming a huge thing that transforms into a workers' party. Most likely it's going to be different streams. Progressive union people, hopefully, progressives or left-wingers from the Green Party, and other formations we don't know about at this point. I just read about I hate the word third party, but a progressive non-Republican, non-Democratic party, which might be sort of black nationalist, but it looked interesting, happening in Baltimore. And there's also, of course, at any time in the U.S., it's interesting, there are independent, candidates, if you really dig for them, in a lot of places, because I don't want to get into a whole thing about why socialism continues as a movement, but, you know, capitalism basically churns up opposition to itself, and some of that opposition takes, because of the conditions it creates, takes an organized form of socialism, getting into the ideas of how capitalism could be replaced by a better system. And so there are more people right now, for example, registering as independents than ever before. Now, I'm not saying they're all socialists or anything, but it's just an example of dissatisfaction with the two parties. That plus, an increase in support for socialism in a very general sense, that plus increased dissatisfaction with in general. I read an article the other day, I don't think I brought it in with me today, but how millennials tend to identify as working class more than recent previous generations. And anyway, there's a lot of signs pointing to a fundamental shift in U.S. society politically that is, you know, not well organized, not going in one straight line, not following one stream to some sort of oceanic, mass movement, but instead disparate, localized, but often with similar reasons, movements and individuals and groups that are tending towards socialism. And we'll get more into that in a minute. I'm going to take a break here. And you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio on 91.5 FM, Tufts Free Forum, commercial-free community-based radio. We're also known as WMFO in Medford. And we are here, Socialist Alternative Radio is here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Check us out on Facebook, Socialist Alternative Radio. And check out Socialist Alternative in general by going to socialistalternative.org. And for any new listeners that just tuned in, this is a show, as you're hearing, believe it or not, that's 110% pro democratic socialism. We're partisans for socialism, for unions, for all sorts of progressive movements and so on. And we are asking you to not just listen to the alternative information we're going to get out there, which we hope will strengthen your own convictions. We hope will help you argue at work the next day or something with your coworkers about politics, if that's something that can happen, or to get you involved in political movements that are happening. For example, coming up in Boston on I think April 14th in the afternoon, there'll be a $15 minimum wage rally sponsored by Fight for 15 and Service Employees International Union and others, Jobs with Justice. We're not just trying to get you involved in movements. That's extremely important. We're not just trying to get you alternative information. Extremely important. We're trying to get you to consider becoming a socialist. And as a socialist, that means, I think by definition, you will be an activist, even if at times you can't be fully active for some personal reason or something, but you in general will be an activist, and you will be hooked into a network of socialists. If you join Socialist Alternative, network of socialists that is in political solidarity with other socialists from around the globe as well. So there are ways to go beyond passive anger, which, you know, and I understand it's hard to encounter the left in a country this big where socialist groups like Socialist Alternative don't have the resources to reach into every city, every neighborhood, etc., with presenting an alternative way of acting politically and but also of analyzing things to avoid demoralization and so on, and that there is a way forward for working people in this country and for socialism in this country. Again, we are WMFO in Medford, and we're going to take that break. We're going to go with a song here. I hope I queued it up right. Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. David Bowie passed away recently, and he, I don't know if he was political or not, it was hard to say. I know he came out against Scottish independence when they had the referendum a year or two ago, and I did not like that. I was for, as is Socialist Alternative and Committee for Works International, for Scottish independence, and by the way, independence for Quebec and many other oppressed minorities that have formed into nascent nationalist movements that hopefully will then become more left and more socialist movements and so on. But anyway, Catalan independence, that sort of thing, that's all good from a socialist standpoint. Actually, Lenin, one of the leaders of the Russian Revolution, wrote some really good stuff on the national self-determination and why it might seem like a contradiction for socialists to support the formation of a government when the goal ultimately is a classless, society internationally with no government. But and I know that sounds like anarchism, but it's actually the goal, one of the goals of socialism. But and the way to that is often very, very, non-direct at that goal. It can be, for example, people entering into political struggle with many progressive ideas, but seeing those progressive ideas as only realizable in their perception through having independence for a new government, a new state. And that has severe limitations and is not our ultimate goal as socialists, but there is a way to engage that movement to bring it into an international socialist movement that does say, yeah, okay, you have a right to self-determination, because, hey, why have any loyalty towards the screwed up way based on economic factors that the globe is divided right now under borders of capitalism, the borders created by the bourgeois, by the capitalist ruling